Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to another episode here of Crime and Science Radio, of course hosted by Doug Lyle and Jan Burke. Today's show is called Things That Go Boom in the Night, an interview with weapons and explosive expert, author John Gilstrap. So without any further ado, let's kick it over to the host of our show, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, welcome, everyone, to this edition of Crime and Science Radio. Tonight, we have our good friend John Gilstrap on here, and John is a man of many talents and wears many hats. He's a renowned safety expert and has extensive knowledge, as you will see, in explosives and weapons of various varieties, hazardous materials, fires, and how they work. He's also a New York Times bestselling author, who's written many books, and he's actually had four of his books either purchased or optioned for the big screen. He's also written four screenplays. So he lives in Fairfax, Virginia now, but here he is on Crime and Science Radio. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Boy, you sure do not sound, you sound more like a neighbor than you do a Californian when you talk.
That's because Virginia and Alabama are 9 iron apart.
Well, John, it's great to have you with us today. I was very interested to read, being a history major myself, that you got a degree in history from William and Mary. So what drew you to history?
Well, I grew up in Virginia, right along the path for both of the Manassas campaigns in the Civil War. And across the street, behind the house across the street from me, were the remains of some old readouts that had been built and overgrown and what have you. So I have always been drawn to history in general. That part of history, in particular American history, the European, the Greek stuff and all that has never attracted me. But U.S. history always did. And my intention was, when I went to do it as a major, was to turn that into a journalism career. And that just didn't work for a number of reasons, not the least of which was I realized I didn't like to write news stories. I wanted to tell stories, which I think ties back into the history degree, because when it's taught well, and I was blessed to have a lot of really good history teachers all through school, but certainly in college, it is storytelling. You know, history, when it's well done, is the study of people in a certain time. Not so much the dates and all that comes with it, but, you know, it's we are the result of our history, and that's all wonderful little stories, and I've just always been drawn to it.
Yeah, I agree. I also think, you know, if you look at the work of a historian, as Robin Winks, professor of history at Yale, said, you know, many years ago, the historian is detective. It really, the work of the historian is a lot like detective work. You're looking at evidence, you're looking at motivations. It's very well suited for this kind of stuff, I think, too.
A lot of it is so contradictory. I mean, history only happened the way it happened, but the research into it is, I mean, how many books have been written on Thomas Jefferson or on Abraham Lincoln, and there's always a new take. It's I find it fascinating.
Yes, absolutely right, yes. And you have to weigh which of that, you know, is worth paying attention to, and why do people tell the story the way they tell it? Yeah. Love it. Well, you were at a fabulous college for it, too, as well. But from there, and this is not what maybe most history majors would do, although it is a really lucrative field to go into, right? you became a volunteer fireman for the Burke, no relation to me, by the way, to the Burke Volunteer Fire Department in Fairfax County. and then later worked in Prince William County. Those are both in Virginia for the Geographically Challenged. So what led you to work as a fireman after being a history major?
It started out, I think, I was 22, I think, when I first started riding fire trucks. And there was a real adrenaline rush to it. You know, I got drawn into it. I worked at a summer camp, and a kid got hit by a car, and I was the first one to help him. He was really hit. It was really, really badly hurt. And I didn't know what to do. I mean, I had no clue what to do. So I decided to take an EMT class so that would never happen to me again. Mm. And then I got bitten by the bug, and once you start riding ambulances, fire trucks start looking pretty good too. And but if you think about it, okay, you're 22, 23 years old, and you walk into the worst moment of somebody's life, and they look, I am 911 at that point, and they're looking to me to bring order to this chaos, and I have the skills to do it. And, you know, outside of the military, which I was never a part, but outside of the military, you don't find that level of responsibility and adrenaline at that age. And it was really addictive. I loved it. I ran thousands of calls.
Well, I mean, that's absolutely true, you know, and I've practiced medicine over 40 years, so you do see people at their single most stressful moment in their life. There's probably nothing more terrifying than being ill or injured on an individual basis. And so, as you well know, and you probably saw, 90% of people are heroic about it, and 10% are assholes. You know, and,
yeah,
and everywhere in between. But you deal with whichever you got in front of you and go on from there. So as a volunteer fireman, what was that like? I mean, how did your life roll at that time, as it were? I mean, you're at home, you get a call. What goes on?
Well, I'm not always at home, but in the day, if I'm home and I get a call, I had a little Kojak light you put up on top of your car, a little flashing red light. You drive down to the firehouse, and I remember the volunteer department that I was with ran 14,000 calls a year.
Wow!
So it was all volunteer. There was a paid crew from 7 in the morning till 5 at night, Monday through Friday, and all the rest of the time it was all volunteer, including all the federal holidays where the paid guys had off. So we also had duty crews that 24-hour shifts that rotated on a six-day cycle. So, you know, it'd be Wednesday this week and Tuesday the next week and Monday the next week. And or 24-hour, but you had a job, so it was close to the 24 hours as you could get. So you would, you know, you're under the firehouse, and you get in the fire truck, and you figure out where you're going, and then you wing it from there. And it was just, there's absolutely nothing like it. You know, for the folks who are listening to this, if you're on the fence about getting involved with the emergency services, there are scary moments to it, but it is so exciting. I've delivered babies. I've held people's hands when they died. I have saved lives. I've rescued people out of burning buildings. You do, and then you go home. You know, it's just fabulous. Where I think I had it better than you did, Doug. I mean, you did medicine in the fixed setting, in the hospitals and what have you. You know, I always got to walk away. So after I had, if there was a really bad auto accident or something, and I would drop them off. They were always alive, even if they didn't have a pulse. As far as I was concerned, they were alive. And then I could walk away. And I think hospital workers then have to deal with, they have to fix what I broke. But they also have to deal with the aftermath of all of that. It was really fascinating. Now, my wife will tell you that it was an excuse. I would go to the grocery store and be gone for 4 hours because I'd go to the firehouse and there'd be a call.
That's right. I mean, that's what attracts people to emergency medicine is it's like that, episodic. You see the person when they present. You fix a few problems, then you pass them off to the people who are going to take care of them later, you know, in the hospital, the surgeons, whoever, you know.
Right.
And what you're doing was pretty much one step in front of that and then that step. Were there some unusual situations while you were doing this you got into, or you mentioned, you know, going into burning buildings and things like that? Did you or yourself have any situations, other, obviously, than that first one when you didn't know what to do, which was probably absolutely terrifying? Any other situations where hey, wow, this is cool and I did a good job, or oh, wow, I hope I don't mess my pants?
Well, a couple come to mind right away. On the EMS side of things, the medical services side of things, when you're dealing with the crazies, that's always unsettling. You know, you're completely unarmed. Well, I have a Halligan bar, you know, a big heavy piece of iron, but you know, the guy's got a gun. That's unsettling. There was one occasion probably, and this had an effect on my life, and it was more heartrending than scary. It's a fairly long story, but I'll keep it short. There was a lady, it was an attempted suicide call that we got, and I arrived, I was in the ambulance, and so my driver and I go in, and it's a suburban house, and the family is just going apeshit. They're completely out of control. She's killing herself. And we go in, and it was grandma who had just gotten a diagnosis of something she didn't like, and she'd taken a couple of pill bottles and was downing a fifth of vodka when I got there. And the laws of Virginia are such that, you know, implied consent only comes into play after the person is unconscious. And this lady, remember, I'm like 24 years old at this point, and this lady is saying, if you touch me and I live, I will sue you for everything you've got, which wasn't much, but she was absolutely right that it's assault in Virginia. Huh. So the long story is, after about 3 hours, we tried to get her arrested. So then she'd be in custody of the county, but the cops, you know, she's not doing anything. We tried to find a judge that would take her into custody, and this was 5:30 on a Friday afternoon. You know, you try to find a judge. And the bottom line, we watched her die. I mean, it was it was that horrifying. And, you know, that's tough. You know, you expect the whole, you know, you get into this, you're going to deal with sick and injured kids, and you're going to do, and those are all very disturbing. But to watch this, you know, very cogent, thought out plan to kill herself, and this just seemed like the best way to do it, that was unsettling.
Huh. Mm. Have those laws changed? Are they still?
I don't know. I haven't. Yeah. I haven't ridden a fire truck in 15 years now. So I don't. I haven't.
I didn't know if you'd heard.
I also fell through a floor one time. That was. That was exciting. I found the seat of the fire, though. It was right under me. And I learned that if you scream like a little girl, people will come and rescue you.
Well, you know, every little girl knows that can come in handy.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. Well, after working as a fireman, you moved on to a master's degree in safety engineering from USC, which is both a subject and a geographical jump. So why that specialty and why there?
Well, I was at that point, I was working, my paycheck was coming from a trade journal that I was writing called Construction Magazine. And I hated it. I hated every moment of it, not the least of which was my boss was a drunk, and that's always exciting. And I was doing really ate up with a volunteer fire service at the time. I never wanted to be a paid firefighter. That never turned me on. So I found out that there is such a thing as a safety engineer. Who knew? And it gets into fire protection and, you know, a lot of other elements that I found interesting. And the University of Southern California came to me. In Crystal City, Virginia, there was a program. They had the Institute of Safety and Systems Management, I think. It offered a master's degree program. And so I ended up joining that. So I was going to school, and I was running fire, and I was working my job. And while I was there, I met a guy who was looking for a safety engineer for his explosives plant. And come on, you know, and I get to blow stuff up and then put out the fire afterwards. Does it get better than that? So that's where I started, and that led to a solid 30-year career of the safety business, which, you know, I specialized in hazardous materials, explosives, chemical weapons, you know, that kind of stuff. And it just it's always been interesting.
Well, for our listeners who don't know what a safety engineer does, tell us more about that occupation and what safety engineers do.
I will tell this in the form of an anecdote. When I was the head of the safety department for the explosives plant, we were the facility, not my department, was behind on a $1 billion with a B Air Force program, and this is for a rocket propellant, very energetic rocket propellant, and you make rocket propellant in a mixer. It's literally a big Hobart mixer, the same thing they use in bakeries, and you just load it with far more exotic things. And because of a lot of yada yada, the place has to be really spotless. Otherwise, you blow the building up, and you blow that up, it's a huge explosion. So we were behind, and one of my staff called and said, "Hey, John, you got to get down here." So I went down, and this place was filthy. And all the program guys were saying, "Well, you know, we really need to do this, and maybe if we evacuate the plant." Or maybe if there were all these workarounds that they were trying to do, and they needed my signature to make it happen. That's the deal. Nothing happened at the plant without the safety department signature. So I ended up pulling the director of production, the guy who owned this place. I pulled him aside and I said, "Look, Bill, there's only two ways to do this. You're not doing this mix. There's no way I'm going to sign it the way it is. Now I can tell people that you're not going to do it." And I'm just going to be the friggin' safety guy getting in the way, or you can tell the folks that you're not going to do it, and then you become the heroic production manager who cares for his employees. Which way do you want to go? And he chose the right way, and we got it fixed in like 4 hours. You know, when there's no other option but to do it right, you can get it done in a relatively short period of time. Just took a lot of manpower. So what a safety guy does is take some of the panic out of the production folks. You know, we got to get it done right now, and, you know, we'll look the other way on regulations and what have you, and we're the voice of sanity that says, no, you're not going to do that.
Well, and brilliant boss handling, I must say.
I have never been, I was more scared in that confrontation. And we're talking a $1 billion program, and I literally was the guy in the way of it. And I was more scared in that confrontation than I think I've ever been scared in a fire.
That's interesting. You mentioned mixing the things up, which reminded me, during World War II, my mother worked on an assembly line basically at the Redstone Arsenal in Huntsville making munitions, and she said they would stir up that stuff. It was like molasses but smelled like sulfur, and they would stir it up in big vats, and all they wore were like face masks, you know, and gloves, and then they would put it into the bombs and then carefully screw the ends on and put them on the line that carried them off, and off they went to World War II. And she did that for a couple of years.
Well, you know, old bombs were just the dumbest, and not dumb as in, you know, just there was no technology. It was a big steel bottle of explosives, you know, and a fuse. There was not a lot. There was some fins, maybe.
Well, now, you know, you're kind of recognized, and for sure in the writing world, the thriller writing world, as an expert on explosives, of course, which is explained by your background and weapons and all kinds of things that go boom in the night. And I know you've taught at Craft Fest before to writers to tell them how things work. How did you, obviously you had a lot of knowledge, but how did you get into that direction of starting to teach people more about explosives and weapons and what led you in that direction?
Well, it goes way back. When I was working at the explosives plant, I was the head of the safety department, which means that I did the new employee orientation on don't let this happen to you. And and there are some, I tell you what, if we should encourage terrorists everywhere to go and buy the anarchist cookbook or some of these do-it-yourself things and make sure they make their bombs that way, because it is scary. That's a quick way to die. And so, you know, it's just over time I developed this expertise over, you know, thousands of accident investigations that I performed over the years. And I've always liked the firearm side of things, and I have knowledge in the explosive side of things, and writers in general just get it all wrong because they watch television, and television gets it all wrong.
Yeah.
So well, it was sort of a labor of love, I guess.
Yeah. Well, why don't you take us down that road a little bit, the things that you do teach, because a lot of people don't know the difference between semi-automatic and automatic and rifle and shotgun and revolver and handgun, and they don't know what these terms mean and how they really differ from each other. So why don't you give us a thumbnail on what weapons are really all about?
Well, you know, we talk firearms here because there's a lot of different,
right.
You know, baseball bat is a weapon. So
exactly.
But when it comes to ballistic weapons, firearms, anything that creates a controlled explosion inside a contained chamber, like a gun, and then sends a projectile going the other direction is a firearm. They can be big, they can be little. A pistol is actually, you know, a pistol and a revolver are both a handgun.
Right.
But a revolver and a pistol are different. In a revolver, there is a revolving cylinder that holds the bullets, and as you cock the hammer and pull the trigger, the cylinder rotates and you shoot. Normally, those depends on the caliber. Normally, that's a six shooter. I've seen them as high as 8, 10 if it's 22 caliber. And a pistol is what you see on most of the TV shows. That's a semi-automatic with the slide. You fire the bullet and the slide comes back and ejects the spent shell casing. Slide goes forward and inserts the next round into battery and then you shoot. So, you know, that's what most people get wrong along these lines are things like the scenes we see in the movies where you point a shotgun at a guy and you shoot him and the guy goes flying through the wall on the other side because he got hit with all of this. You know, what's Newton's third law of motion? You know, every action has an equal and opposite reaction. So if you're going to throw that guy, the victim, through that wall, then the shooter's got to go through the other wall because that would be the forces that are involved. Now, for the long
term, energy.
Yeah. And listen to your physics teachers, folks. You know that you're learning good stuff. Now, if physics teachers could teach it that way in high school, there'd be a lot more boys involved in physics classes. But
yeah.
I digress. Other forms, you know, rifles are long guns. It's the same principle. There actually are revolving rifles, but that's very old technology. That's the 1800s. So in rifles, they're either semi-automatic, which is it's got a slide. It's kind of like the semi-automatic pistol, but it's got a bolt instead of a slide. So for you pull the trigger, the bullet goes out the barrel, the bolt comes back, ejects a spent round, and you're done until you pull the trigger again. That's a semi-automatic rifle. A fully automatic rifle is you pull the trigger, and it just keeps shooting until there's no more bullets left. Shotguns are non-rifled long guns. In order for with a rifle, the term comes from grooves that are cut into the inside of the barrel that impart a spin on the bullet as it's pushed out by the gunpowder. So once the bullet starts traveling, it's stable in the air, much like a well-thrown football is stable if it's got the spiral in it. So those grooves are called rifling. So a long gun that has rifling is called a rifle. A shotgun is, or a musket, but you don't see a lot of muskets anymore. A shotgun is just a smoothbore gun that fires non-spiraling projectiles out the other end, and normally much closer range weapon, and depending on what you're shooting through the shotgun, either a slug or shotgun pellets of varying sizes, you get a much larger spray of the bullets. This is hard to do on radio. You should see what I'm doing with my hands now as I'm explaining this.
We're just trying to put you on the spot, that's all. Yeah. You're doing great. It is hard.
Yes. Well, so, and using, maybe we should look at both firearms and weapons here, but what are the common, let me start with firearms. What are the common firearms carried by law enforcement versus the ones that are favored by the criminals?
Well, I can't speak to the bad guys. I think bad guys will use whatever they can get. In fact, I heard a guy with the GBI, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, saying that, you know, half the time they arrest these gangbangers and, you know, the guns have the wrong bullets in them. You know, they're just not a lot of ballisticians among the gangbangers. But on law enforcement, the general trend, and obviously there's a lot of different agencies and they all make their own decisions, the current trend is to go toward a semi-automatic pistol. 9mm is probably the favored one. Other agencies use 40 caliber. By the way, caliber means, a 40 caliber means it's four-tenths, the bullet is four-tenths of an inch in diameter at its widest point. That's what that means. A 9mm bullet is 9mm in diameter at the widest point. So the reason they have gone, most agencies have gone to the semi-automatic pistols, is they can hold more ammunition. The days of the old six-shooter, quite literally you're out in six shots, as opposed to some of the Glocks and Sig Sauers that are probably in my, you know, I haven't done a survey on this, but just from visualizing, those are probably the two favored manufacturers. They'll carry as many as 15 or 17 rounds in the magazine. So that's a lot of shooting. Hopefully it's a lot of shooting back that they use. For SWAT teams and such, there's a lot of controversy. I mean, if you get into the I call it gun porn, into the various websites and such that are dedicated to this stuff, there's a lot of discussion when it comes to SWAT team weapons. The classic, remember from what's the Bruce Willis movie with the big tower? Nakatomi.
Die Hard.
All the bad guys had MP5s, which is a Heckler & Koch product. And they shoot a 9mm pistol bullet. And they shoot a lot of them, and they're really cool looking. And looking cool is really important. Actually, a buddy of mine who's in Special Forces on these assault teams, he said there's three things to remember. Number one, look cool. Number two, know your shit. Number three, look cool. But, you know, the pistol caliber carbines hit just like a pistol. So there is, a lot of agencies are moving more toward the M16 AR-15 variant, which is a 5.56 millimeter, a 223 caliber. It's the M16 round. It's a rifle bullet. And they're coming in smaller and smaller platforms all the time.
So just to footnote that really quickly, in case we have listeners who don't know, what makes a weapon a carbine?
It's a little rifle.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really what it means. For civilians, it's illegal to own a rifle with shorter than a 16-inch barrel. So, and I don't know what the breakover. It's interesting. There's probably a number that says if the barrel is more than X, then it's a rifle as opposed to a carbine. But I don't know what that is.
Okay. Well, speaking of other things that you know, for those who like to blow stuff up, explosives also have various classifications. So, can you tell us about the different types of explosive materials and how they work?
Sure. Okay. An explosion is a rapid release of gas, creating noise. So you pop a balloon, you've got all that contained gas that's inside the latex. And you'll notice that a latex balloon makes a bigger bang than some of these Mylar, whatever those other materials for a balloon are. They tend to just hiss as opposed to blow up if you poke a latex balloon, and that's because the latex balloon is holding more pressure. It's able to expand and get bigger so that when you poke a hole, all of that contained air expands right away in your ears, hear it as a boom. So that's what an explosion is. An explosive is something that creates that some way. And you can, you know, there's, we've all heard, explosions go from whomp to bang to holy crap, right? And the two basic classifications of explosives, you have low explosives or low explosions, low order explosions, or you have high order explosions that are caused by high explosives. The difference is the speed of the pressure wave. If the pressure wave, if the you take an explosive like C4 or TNT, take TNT. TNT, the detonation velocity, if you ran out a string of TNT and you put a blasting cap on one end of it and you hit it, that string would go away, 14 miles of it goes away in a second. So that's how fast the flame front progresses. Because it's going at a supersonic speed, which is the speed that air molecules can move past each other, you create, beyond the pressure of the explosion itself, that creates a secondary pressure because the air molecules can't get out of the way of the primary pressure wave. So you end up with a shock wave that extends out. This is in a high explosion or 1.1 explosion, depends on how you want to talk about it. Well, whenever you've got a high pressure wave, physics, what has to be behind it? A vacuum, right? So if you have positive pressure, behind that there has to be a vacuum. So what happens is in a high order explosion, the initial pressure wave shatters everything, and then the rarefaction wave, the negative pressure, then tears it all apart and sucks it actually back toward the source of the explosion. So bombs, you know, the stuff that you drop out of the sky, and those tend to be class 1.1 or class A high explosives. Now let's say you want to drop napalm on somebody. Napalm burns much slower than the speed of sound, but it'll go boom when it hits, just because you're bursting the vessel and you're creating this simultaneous ignition of stuff in the air. So that won't do. I mean, it sucks to be under it. No matter, you know, if you're catching the bomb, you're dead. But napalm does not have the pressure damage that's associated with it that a C4 bomb or a RDX bomb would have associated with it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It just spreads and causes fire damage.
Right.
As much as anything
exactly.
else. Yeah.
So there's all kinds of ways. Excuse me. There are all kinds of explosive compounds that are not high explosive, but they'll do the damage that you want them to do. A thermite grenade. It is a grenade. It burns at really high temperature. I want to say 4,000 degrees, but I don't know if that's actually the number. It's really, really high temperature. And you can't stop it. So once it starts burning, and it melts everything, it'll melt steel, concrete, whatever is there, it's going to melt it because it's so freaking hot. And that has uses that napalm can't do. Certainly, you know, you can put a block of C4 on something, it's just going to make it go away. You know, but if you want to maintain what's inside, you use different explosives different ways.
So that's what
I feel like
on
I
the
just
door
had a total geek out there. What now?
That's what they would put on the door to burn through it, a thermite.
If it were a bank vault, yes.
Yeah,
but not just to get into somebody's house.
A boot works well for that.
It does. It does. And there are shotgun shells that are made specifically for that purpose, to blow off locks.
Huh.
You know, for folks who are listening to this, you know, the internet can get you in trouble, but a lot of this stuff is covered very, very well. Actually, Wikipedia is, when it comes to explosive stuff, I find it to be very well sourced and very helpful.
So when we see, say, someone who wants to demolish an old hotel in Las Vegas, then they're counting on the part of this that pulls it in, I'm assuming. So you don't want something that radiates out too far, right?
No. What you're doing there is, and this is not my business. I have never done controlled demolition, so I'm speaking a little out of my hat, but it's my understanding of it. They use what's called they're called shaped charges in a controlled explosion. So imagine that you've got a cone, like a martini glass shape of explosives, right? And it's carefully molded. Well, and the rim, the entire cone is made out of the explosive material you're using. That explosion is omnidirectional. So you're going to get as much force on any surface going up as down and left and right. Okay, it's omnidirectional. But inside the cone, the blast waves that are coming towards the center there's a geometric progression of pressure that can then direct a pressure wave like with pinpoint accuracy into a particular spot. So as I understand what's happening in these controlled demolitions, you're actually taking down the structural members. But you want to make sure that structural member A goes before structural member Z,
right,
or else you end up with the building falling down. So what they're really doing is creating a pancake collapse, but it doesn't have to do with the rarefaction wave, I don't think.
Oh, okay. I've always fascinated me that that's even possible. Those are people that really paid attention in physics class.
and that's there's a very stressed safety guy who has to sign off on it and says, yeah, okay, we're ready. Oh, wait.
Well, without getting into specifics for obvious reasons, how easy is it to make a homemade bomb?
Well, I mean, if you got a chemistry set, you can make fairly exotic things. But just household stuff or stuff you can go down to the local hardware store and buy, sure. I mean, it's the hard part is not making the explosive. The hard part is the initiating device that goes off while you're not there. That's far more technical than actually making the thing that blows up. But, you know, one of the most elegant explosives around, it's called ANFO, which is ammonium nitrate and fuel oil. It is literally fertilizer and fuel oil. And you mix it together, and if you hit it hard enough with a blasting cap, that's what brought down the Murrah building in Oklahoma City.
Mm-hmm.
And matchhead bombs. How I lived to be 14 I can't understand how. But
we used to build rockets and power them with crushed up match heads and emptied shotgun shells, and
yeah,
you know, and it was amazing. Of course, we made my little sister be the ignition officer, but which was basically a little gasoline stolen from the lawnmower, put in a mayonnaise jar lid, set under the rocket, and Melinda'd have to go light it and run. We would be hiding behind the garage.
Yeah. when I was a kid, when I was 7 years old, we were playing with a can of gasoline, hot summer day out behind the Weber's house, and it's important because it wasn't my house, and we were not well supervised. It was like a coffee can of gasoline,
and
we had a book of matches.
Yep.
And I was 7, my brother was 11, I guess, and he told me you can put out a match in a can of gasoline. And it led into the you know, that brotherly thing.
Yeah, right.
So I said, okay. So he handed me the book of matches.
Was this dog dare?
Yeah, exactly. So I lit the match, then I lit the book, because what's the sense of having the rest of the book? And I threw it into the can of gasoline, and I proved my brother to be a friggin' liar.
Yeah.
Because it didn't go out. It did entirely the opposite. And he ran because he was older and smarter. But I was worried that if my mom saw me, you know, we're going to get the ass whooping of a life. So I did what made sense. I kicked the can of gasoline.
Oh, yeah.
To put it out down the side of the Weber's house. So, yeah. I learned my mother knew kung fu.
The volunteer firefighter is starting. Pictures.
Exactly.
A little more into focus now, isn't it?
It is. The seeds of that are starting to appear.
Well, I swear I never set one to put it out. Never did. I knew there were those who did that, but I was never one of them.
Yeah.
But to your question, you know, to make a homemade bomb, it's a matter of taking something that will burn and then you contain it until the pressure builds, the internal pressure builds higher than the container's ability to contain it. And then
right.
it goes boom. That's it. That's the whole, it's really not exotic science. It gets exotic when you really want to do very specific things. But if you just want to make a big hole, or just want to hurt a bunch of people, it's frighteningly easy to do.
Yeah, I imagine that though you don't have a lot of old amateurs in that line of work.
And also, this is radio. You can't see, but I swear I have all 10 fingers. So.
Well, yeah, you mentioned earlier, you know, that you'd written for some professional trade magazines and things like that in various publications. But you also moved on into book-length nonfiction, notably Six Men, which is the story of Kurt Muse.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
You know, that is one of the best experiences. It almost bankrupted me. It took me 4 years to write the damn thing. But I met Kurt Muse, and the book's name is 6 Minutes to Freedom. Always be marketing, 6 Minutes to Freedom. I met Kurt Muse through a third party, and he ran a pirate radio network that was intended to bring down Manuel Noriega in the late 80s, because Noriega was a very, very bad man, and he had murdered a couple of Kurt's friends. And Kurt, who is an American expat, I mean, the guy is, he's red hair, 6'3", you know, in Panama, he stands out in a crowd. So it was he and a bunch of Rotarians that got together and ran this radio network. And long story short, he was ultimately betrayed and arrested. And on the night he was arrested, his 15-year-old daughter was home alone with her 12-year-old brother. And they had to flee the country by themselves. And then ultimately, Kurt was arrested. The rest of the story happens, but then he's the he was rescued by Delta Force in the opening moments of Operation Just Cause, the invasion of Panama on December 20th, 1989. And it's just, it was a fascinating story as he told it. I didn't believe him when he told it, because how could I not have heard this story before? But it all checked out. And the problem is, a lot of the story lies with Delta Force. And you, I don't know if you know any of these guys, they're not real talkative.
Right.
And, you know, I worked and worked and worked, and ultimately here's what happened. Senator Connie Mack of Florida had visited Kurt, you know, going back in the 80s. I was writing this in 2002, I guess. And so Senator Mack had visited. We had lunch with him, and then he turned us on to General Scowcroft, who was 41's national security advisor. And he grilled us. You know, what are we trying to do? Is this a hatchet job? He said, no, I just want to tell a story. I just want to tell a story of what happened. I mean, it was very heroic stuff. So then about a week later, I got a call from President Bush's secretary, 41 secretary, saying the president would like to meet with you next Thursday. Can you be here? I said, well, yeah, go. There's actually a hole in my schedule for that very thing. So we went down. We were supposed to meet with President Bush for 20 minutes. It turned out to be about an hour and a half, hour 45 minutes that we sat and talked with him. And then a week later, we got a call from the commander of Delta at the time and said, okay, those guys will talk to you and tell you whatever you want to know.
Wow.
And then the book came out. And it's that one, actually, if Hollywood is telling the truth, that should start shooting as a movie sometime in the summer.
Huh. That'd be great. I want to see that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do too.
Yeah.
Well, after that experience, you moved on to fiction, and you created this wonderful character, Jonathan Graves. So tell us how you put him together and how you created him and who he is and how much of him is you and how much of him is the people you've met along the way.
Well, he's the me I would like to be if I were in better shape and had hair. you know, I had all this research that I did for 6 Minutes to Freedom, and I so admire that community and the folks who are in it. They are not as they are portrayed on movies. They're very kind, gentle folks who have, you know, can be very violent when drawn to do so, but only for their mission. And what I came to realize during the research is that if you're kidnapped or taken hostage overseas, the American security forces start working on a plan for your rescue right away. It may or may not get pulled off, but if it is pulled off, 9 times out of 10 will be local assets, local police or whatever. But in part of the world where the police are not friendly, it's either going to be Navy SEALs or a Delta Force that effect the rescue. And when that happens, the mission is to rescue the good guy. Nothing else matters. Rescue the good guy, get him out. If people point a gun at you, they die. You know, but there's no warrants. There's no, I mean, there's stuff that happens that in command and control center, but on the ground, not so much. But when you're kidnapped by the FBI, when you're kidnapped locally and the FBI is in charge on domestic turf, and the FBI hostage rescue team, great guys, very talented, but they got to worry about all the constitutional stuff. And, you know, wiretaps, you can't just listen. You got to, there's all these hoops you got to jump through. And the reality is, it is the hostages in, I had an FBI hostage rescue team guy tell me that they consider the hostage, that's a slow motion homicide. The real mission, yes, certainly they want to rescue the hostage, but really it's about arresting the bad guys and making sure that they don't escape. So Jonathan Grave takes he's a former Delta operator who's a freelance hostage rescue guy. So he takes the overseas model and applies it domestically. So if your loved one is taken, you call Jonathan, and he brings him back to you, and there won't necessarily be a lot of evidence to use in a prosecution.
Well, I'm just thinking here for, just on the off chance there's somebody that doesn't know what Delta Force is, maybe talk a little bit more about what Delta Force is and how your knowledge of Delta Force and weapons and explosives plays into your books.
Well, Delta Force is the first Special Forces Operational Detachment Delta out of Fort Bragg. It is a unit that, and that's what they call themselves, by the way, is the unit, that does not officially exist anywhere. It's a legal fiction that all of those guys have an official MOS that is something entirely different than being on Delta Force. But they're the quick reaction force. They're the ones that now in the last 15 years or so, they've been working like crazy. But you want to snatch a bad guy, you want to get intelligence. Delta goes in, they grab him, and they take him back. You want to rescue hostages, Delta goes in. It's the same. It's morphed over time, as I understand it, into SEAL Team 6 and Delta Force. Delta is the Army component, and SEAL Team 6 is the Navy component. But their missions are more or less overlapping these days. They didn't used to, but it's evolved into that. These are just really, they're frontline, heroic guys that do unspeakably heroic things, and often with no credit. I know a bunch of them. They're really, really, really nice guys.
Do some missions employ, you know, people from SEAL teams and from Delta Force together as a unit that goes out, or do they support each other, go out together, but are they ever blended together, you know, to set a squad together to go do something special?
That gets to a level of intelligence data that I don't have access to.
Okay.
I know that they train together,
right.
But I don't know that they're ever deployed together.
Yeah. I'd imagine you call on whatever assets you need.
Well,
in
yeah.
And from all things.
You know, the 160th Air Squadron, the Air Force unit, is a Special Forces air support unit that both of them use. So, you know, the 160th is so it's a very, it's a small community, it's a tight community, but man, is it a talented community. And so in terms of, you know, how does that all affect my fiction? It affects all of it. I have learned a lot from them. I've spent a couple of days at the Navy SEAL compound in Virginia Beach shooting a lot of taxpayer ammunition with pretty exotic weapons and stuff, and a lot of fans in that community of my books, which is also very thrilling for me.
Sure.
That speaks well of you. Well, tell us what's next. What are you working on?
Right now, there's going to be another Grave book called Friendly Fire. Drops on in July 1. The end of this month is a non-Grave, non-series book called Nick of Time. It's being released in 5 parts, actually. It's a serial e-book, and then it'll be a paper book in October. And right now I'm writing Final Target, which is number 9 in the Grave series. Should come out in July of 2017.
Wow.
That's
and you can find all of this on www.johngilstrap.com.
How which, of course, that? We will have on our website, yes.
Yeah, we want to mention to our listeners, we put up links, so we'll have links about some of the stuff we talked about, but definitely to John's website. Yeah.
And I encourage folks, when you go to the website, you know, like I said, this is hard stuff to, the technical stuff is hard to do over the radio, but I correspond with writers all the time who are, you know, I'm trying to do, my character's trying to do this, can I do this and make it work, and I'm happy to work with folks on that, you know, to a degree, but I've never said no.
Yep, John's always generous that way, folks. So he will answer your questions, and he knows what he's talking about, but I think you know that after this. Well, John, this has been a thrill, and it's always great talking to you, you know, whether it's in a bar or here on the radio. We always have some good discussions, and thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and your time with our listeners.
Oh, it's been great. You guys are terrific. I've had a blast.
Good.
Thanks.
No pun intended.
Yeah, right.
All right, folks, until next time, that wraps up this episode of Crime and Science Radio. We'll see you down the road.